From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I'm a little sluttier than the average bear. I really am. A little sluttier. I can be honest about that.
Today we ask comic Amy Schumer if she's really as slutty as her onstage persona. Schumer does stand-up, performs in sketches, and conducts interviews on her Comedy Central series Inside Amy Schumer. Last year she had a special called Mostly Sex Stuff. Her material takes some people by surprise.
I'll get off stage and the club owner will be like, that was a lot about sex. And they would never say that to a male comic.
But her comedy's really about a lot more than sex. And she's really good at insulting people, at roasts of celebrities like Charlie Sheen and Roseanne Barr. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reflects on what Sofia Coppola's new film, The Bling Ring, tells us about the lust for fame. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, Comedy Central shows the next-to-the-last episode in the first season of the series Inside Amy Schumer. It's already been renewed for a second season. Amy Schumer is my guest. Her show is a mix of stand-up, short sketches, and interviews. She plays a lot of different characters in the sketches, but her persona in stand-up comedy is an attractive, middle-class, educated single woman who's a little slutty. As her executive producer Dan Powell put it, she can say the most filthy, obscene things in the sweetest manner. Last year, she had a special on Comedy Central called Mostly Sex Stuff, which was the second highest-rated special on the network in 5 years. You may have seen her roasting celebrities like Roseanne Barr and Charlie Sheen. Mel Brooks recently described her on our show as a new comic he thinks is wonderful. Amy Schumer will not sweetly be saying obscene things on our show, but we are going to have an adult conversation about her comedy, and there may be some punchlines you won't want to explain to young children. Here's an excerpt of Schumer's stand-up comedy from the first episode of Inside Amy Schumer.
I'm a little sluttier than the average bear. I really am. A little sluttier. I can be honest about that. Like, I'm no stranger to Plan B. I'll say that. I'm not like, what is that? Like, I know what it is. It's the morning after pill. You can take it the night before if you're feeling amped, you know? Just like walk by a mirror, catch a glimpse of yourself in a new tube top, like, whoa, pop, you can do that. You feel like such a dirty whore buying Plan B. It is so embarrassing. Because it's over the counter, but you have to ask your pharmacist. And they know what you want, but they make you ask. They're looking at me, I'm like, you see where my eyeliner is, just give it to me. The staring contest. What do you think, I'm here because it's allergy season, really?
That's Amy Schumer from her show Inside Amy Schumer. Amy Schumer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
My sense of responsibility as a journalist requires me to say you really can't take Plan B the night before.
Oh, yes.
I just want to make sure everybody knows that that's a joke and that they don't try that. So
it didn't even occur to me that someone would take that as actual advice. Wow, I should really have more ownership over that. But I like that that was one of the cleaner clips that you found to play.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I just have to ask you, do you really think of yourself as a slut?
I often wonder how attractive I am and how slutty I am. That's something I'm back and forth on. But I think I have been promiscuous, and I think a lot of women have. So I like to talk about it as a way to maybe make those other women feel less alone and less strange and dirty about their own actions.
Tell us more how that became your comic persona.
That wasn't on purpose. I started out very much set up punchline. And I think, you know, I started when I was 22 or 23 years old. So I've always been sexual. I've always been a sexual girl. But it was coming out more and more in my stand-up. So it wasn't a conscious decision. But then I was getting ready to film my hour special for Comedy Central. And they said, you know, it's a lot of stuff about sex. Can you maybe mix it up more? Maybe some racism or something else. And I said, why don't we just call it Mostly Sex Stuff? And so it's kind of like a lazy decision. And that was really when I realized, wow, it is a lot of stuff about sex. But I didn't grow up hearing any women really delving into that side of themselves. And so I thought, maybe I can be this person for women and for men, just to hear the woman's perspective in a you know, like less apologetic, honest way. And I don't know if I'm going to veer away from that or what, but I've been trying to keep it pretty natural, just stuff I'm interested in talking about.
So a lot of male comics talk about sex a lot on stage,
yeah.
More than your average female comic does. What did you take from that male approach to sex comedy, and what did you reject from it?
Oh, I don't know that I could really generalize a male approach to comedy and sex. But I do know that I'll get off stage and the club owner will be like, that was a lot about sex. And they would never say that to a male comic. Dave Attell or Jim Norton would never get off stage and have a promoter of a theater or a club go over like, you like to talk about sex, you know? So it's just this, there's such a stigma with being a woman who talks about sex, and there's just sort of no repercussions, I think, if you're a male comic that talks about sex. They wouldn't label you that way, I don't think.
So you do talk a lot about sex on stage, and you do use the word vagina a lot on stage. Were you always comfortable talking about sex in front of a microphone and using that word? Because I think a lot of girls grow up feeling like so uncomfortable using any word that describes the sexual parts of their body.
I'm glad you asked that. Well, one thing is my mom, I have a joke where I say I'm going to bring her to a soccer game because I want to show her what boundaries look like. I just grew up in a house where things weren't that taboo to talk about. And my mom, when she was teaching us how to say our different body parts, taught me how to say vagina the same that she taught me how to say ear. I think she wanted us to be able to tell her if we were ever molested without being embarrassed. And so there wasn't this sense of shame. And I was running around naked to an age that probably wasn't appropriate, and just never was made to feel embarrassed or ashamed of my body or think anything was wrong with me, or, you know, and it to probably to a fault, because now if I do a photo shoot, and I'm a comedian, but if any woman shows up to a photo shoot for a magazine, it's usually, you know, they sexualize it. And so they'll be like, well, what about with your shirt off? And I'm like, sure, just because I don't think of that as a big deal. But as I'm getting older, I'm learning to put more value and value my privacy more of my body and some of my personal information. I definitely am an oversharer. And I'm trying to get better with that. As I'm becoming more well known, it's more important for me to keep some of my information private.
So you do some interviews in your shows, and in one set of interviews, you're interviewing people on the street about whether they sexed or not, and whether they like being sexted. And do you ever do that?
Do I sext?
Uh-huh.
Do you mean have I ever sent like a sexual message to somebody over text?
Yes, or picture of yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I, you know, now that I'm more well-known, I can't put my head in them. but no, I don't, I've definitely over the years, yeah, I've been in long-distance relationships and it's definitely happened. Yeah, I have definitely engaged in sexed messaging and received and sent dirty photos. What about you?
Who, me?
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
So one of your sketches ends with, I forget whether you're sexting or what, but it ends with you turning on the end of like an old black and white, like 1930s or 1940s movie where like the romantic finale is the kiss.
And
it's so,
right.
It's so chaste and romantic compared to all the sexting and everything. And do you think that that's the kind of split that you sometimes have in your own life of like doing all this like explicit stuff, but loving like the romantic fantasies of, say, old 1940s movies?
Yeah, I think so. And the scene where I'm sexting, I'm sitting there and a guy doesn't know where he's catching you. He's like, what are you wearing? And I'm sitting there and I'm wearing a t-shirt with a cat on it, wearing a bonnet that says Downton Catty. And I'm eating pasta with my hands. And so I wrote that scene and I thought, what if I wrote back what I was actually thinking, which is, you know, he's like, what do you want me to do to you? And I'm like, tell me I'm safe in my apartment. Tell me what all the remotes do. And then also trying to navigate, what does this guy want me to say? And, you know, like, just, I don't know. And, but yeah, like, just that girls, I still do want that romance and to be adored by someone. But then there's also this high demand to be super sexual. And that's being asked, I think, of a lot of women more and more now. I'm assuming with the younger generation, the sort of sexual demands are so much higher now. And so I think that scene is just showing a real girl just trying to navigate this new territory.
I worry about those sexual expectations. You know, I think for some young women, the attitude is, well, now that we've all been through feminism, now it's safe to be sexual objects again and to learn how to strip for our boyfriends and become pole dancers. And
right.
I mean, do you find that disturbing at all?
Yeah, I think it's totally disturbing. I feel very lucky that I grew up before Facebook and before internet porn. It's such tough territory to navigate now. And I'm just dealing with guys that came up on the end of it where they just were exposed to it. You know, they're in their 30s and some of them have a lot of trouble with it. And there's new addictions because of it. And these new expectations on these girls, like I didn't feel any pressure when I was younger to be overly sexual because there wasn't that much exposure to it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actress Amy Schumer, and her show on Comedy Central is called Inside Amy Schumer. So there's another sketch I want to play, and this is a real girl thing. It's a sketch about how girls handle compliments from other girls. And this sketch starts with two girlfriends running into each other on the street, and Amy Schumer enters the scene a little bit later.
Oh my God, Britt, you dyed your hair. It looks amazing.
Oh no, you're just being nice.
No, seriously, it looks great.
No, I tried to look like Kate Hudson, but ended up looking like a golden retriever's dingleberry.
But you, look at your cute little dress.
Little, I'm like a size 100 now. Anyway, I paid like $2 for it. It's probably made out of old Burger King crowns. I look like a whore locked out of her apartment.
Hi.
Amy.
Hi.
I love your hat.
Are you drunk? I look like an Armenian man. People are trying to buy carpets from me.
Excuse me, when did you start working for NASA? You're weightless.
You, I'm a cow. Indian people are trying to worship me. I sleep standing up in a field.
Hi. Fancy meeting you girls here.
Of course, I see everyone when I look like Susan Boyle's toothbrush.
Ew, looks so pretty.
Miss Jessica, congrats on your big promotion, biatch.
I'm gonna get fired in like 2 seconds.
No.
I'm legally retarded. On my SATs, I just drew a picture of a house on the first page and ate the rest.
Lindsay! That's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer, and Amy Schumer is my guest. I recognize that. I really do.
Oh, good.
That sense of like if somebody says something nice to you that you have to somehow answer it with a self-insult, you know, with something like really
self-derogatory.
What is that about?
I have some ideas. I think it might be because we're afraid of jealousy from other women, or it might be from actual self-hatred. But I know that every girl I know does that. But I think that scene, it went viral, you know, whatever that means. A lot of people watched it and responded to it, and especially women, of course. And they everybody just recognized that behavior in themselves. And I think it has affected the women that have seen it. It's affected me because you catch yourself doing that. We just noticed we were doing it around the writer's office and to a ridiculous degree. We just thought, let's shine a light on this. And we do that as much as possible on the show. But I'm glad that that one resonated with people.
So this was women in the writer's office doing that.
Every scene wound up being a big collaboration, but yeah, it was the women in the office doing it. The men, I've never noticed men doing that. I'll be like, that's a great shirt. And then the guy will just wear that shirt all week.
My guest is comic Amy Schumer. Her series Inside Amy Schumer is on Comedy Central. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. So if you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Schumer, and her new comedy show on Comedy Central is called Inside Amy Schumer. another sketch I want to play from your show. And this is about the difficulty of dealing with older members of your family who blurt out racist things and don't even get why it's racist, why it's like so wrong to say that. And in this scene, like, you and your boyfriend, who's Latino, are at dinner with your family, including your grandmother. And here's the scene, and this is from Inside Amy Schumer.
All of our friends had left us, and we were both stuck there. I mean, Napa Valley of all places, but that's basically how Carlos and I met.
I am very happy to meet you. Also, I'm finished.
Oh my God, Grandma, no, Carlos is not a busboy. He's my boyfriend.
I'm so sorry. Amy, it's okay. She grew up during a different time.
Tell him to start mowing the lawn by the pool so it'll be quiet for my nap.
Look familiar? Are you tired of your elderly relatives thinking their blatant racism is okay?
I don't know how to help my grandma.
There is an answer. Generations. A revolutionary new facility where we give your elderly loved ones the politically correct social skills to get along in the modern world.
This person is what?
Drug mule.
A gardener?
No, Latino.
That's really funny.
Thank you.
Have you experienced this with relatives or
Yes,
or
I
friends?
Wrote this scene and I've definitely experienced that with relatives. My great-grandma, who was a bootlegger, old New York, she, Estelle Schumer, she passed away a couple of years ago, but her liquor store is still up on 54th Street. But she, you know, all New York, she was 90, I think, 4 when she died, or 95, and she would just sort of, she would just say a word. She would call black people colored, and it would just make all the blood rush to my head. Like, no, that's not okay. But then you think, well, she's so old. And then, you know, I would mention that to my friends. And then it just, I realize everybody has, you know, most people I know have older relatives that will just say something that's so unacceptable. And then I just thought, well, what's the age? What's the cutoff? Because if one of my parents said something inappropriate, I would stop them. So, and it seems like a lot of people have had this experience. And so I had the idea to film this scene.
Did you say anything to her ever?
No. I was scared of her. She was terrifying. I mean, she was like so tiny by the end of her life. She was just sort of like slowly going into downward dog. But I was just so afraid of her. I never said anything to her.
One of the things you say in one of your stand-up routines is that every woman has probably been a little bit raped. What do you mean?
Let's get into it, Terry.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
I most women I know that I'm close to have had a sexual experience that they were really uncomfortable with, and that if it wasn't completely rape, it was something very similar to rape. And so I say it's not all black and white. There's a gray area of rape. I call it grape. And it's the guy you went home with in college and you said no and then he still did it, or maybe you woke up and it was somebody you were dating and they were sleep. You know, there's just so many different things that can happen. And so it's not always this, well, you're going to jail and, you know, and that's it. There's other stuff where it's like, wow, it would be so much work, and it would be such a life changer for me to press charges or take any action against this person. But every girl I know has had some experience that is kind of like grape.
Do you get a big response when you say that?
Yeah, the women all laugh, and then the men look to see if they're allowed to laugh, and then they laugh. But I wondered when I first started that, and then when everything happened in Steubenville, I wondered, oh, should I stop saying that? But it just really still struck a chord in people, and it was it was a powerful response of just, yeah, that's true. It was just another, yeah, this is something that happens.
So are you at all concerned that making jokes about being, you know, quote, slightly raped will diminish the importance of talking about rape and of taking it seriously?
No, not the way I'm saying it. If anything, I hope it will raise more awareness and make people feel more comfortable having a conversation about it. If you listen to the whole, that whole joke, I say someone sleeping, that's a no. Because I say that at a certain age, men take a woman sleeping as a suggested no. And I say, that's a no. And I say, there's this other area. And I say, everyone has been a little raped. I think I'm bringing the conversation to the table so that people will feel more comfortable to talk about it. I'm in no way, my intention is not to minimize how serious rape is, and I don't think I'm doing that. And that's not the response that I've gotten to that joke. But I do take more responsibility now over my material and the reaction to it. And I was especially careful with that subject.
Amy Schumer will be back in the second half of the show. A new episode of her series Inside Amy Schumer will be shown on Comedy Central tonight. You'll find a link to her sketch about the difficulty women have accepting compliments on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Anti Records, featuring Mavis Staples, reunited with Wilco's Jeff Tweedy for the new studio album, One True Vine, available now. From Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, an electric car with a gas generator to help drivers charge forward. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And from Citco, offering Tri-Clean gasoline, designed to keep fuel injectors and intake valves clean while minimizing emissions. More at FuelingGood.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Amy Schumer talks about performing at roasts for celebrities like Charlie Sheen and Roseanne Barr. She received death threats after a joke at one roast. Also, Sofia Coppola's new film, The Bling Ring, leads our critic at large, John Powers, to reflect on celebrity mania. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Amy Schumer. Her series, Inside Amy Schumer, is on Comedy Central. A new episode will be shown this evening. She also did a special for that network called Mostly Sex Stuff. She was featured in an episode of Girls, and you may have seen her on Comedy Central Celebrity Roasts. You've done some very high-profile roasts, like Charlie Sheen and Roseanne Barr, who she really complimented you at the end of that roast.
I know. I started crying.
Oh, seriously?
That was so nice. Yeah, I was so moved by that.
I think that's the first time I heard your name. In fact, you know, I turned into the end of the roast, and Roseanne Barr sang in that Amy Schumer. She was so funny, and I thought, oh, Amy Schumer, who is? I don't know who that is. Who is that?
Oh, that's awesome. Roseanne plugged me and made you discover me. Yeah, that was such a special moment. And yeah, I was really not expecting that. It's a roast. It's such, you know, everyone's claws are out. And then to get a compliment like that from someone I just grew up loving and thinking was so hilarious.
And from somebody who just had every insult in the books thrown at them in in a comedic fashion.
Yeah. I think the comedians really, that's such a place for comedians to shine. We just know that there's no venom, and it's just we just appreciate each other constructing jokes, and I did my best to be careful. I'm more careful with women at those roasts. I wouldn't want to say anything that would actually offend.
Why are you more careful with women?
There's just more territory that I feel like you can't say certain things to women. I think attacking a woman's appearance is, I just know how wounding that is. And
daily life itself.
yeah, right, exactly. Just too many people just every day will say something, just a backhanded compliment or just a flat out insult. And maybe they don't even realize that they think it's something that you've accepted or, you know, and they'll just hand you a new insecurity. And I would not want to be someone to do that. So I definitely, you know, said hard jokes, but I wouldn't say anything about a woman's appearance that I thought might hurt her feelings.
How did you get on the roast circuit, so to speak?
I just had a relationship with Comedy Central, and they know me. They know that I've sort of been trained since birth, I think, to do a roast. I like writing set up punchlines, and I can be harsh, and they know that about me. But I submitted to write for the Charlie Sheen roast. I just sent in a packet, and then you make it onto the next round, and then they have you write. They make up a fictitious roast. You know, we're roasting Kanye West and Jennifer Aniston, for example. And then you write jokes as though you're roasting them, and you submit them. So I made it through a couple rounds, and then I didn't get it. They were like, you didn't get it. And I was, you know, I was disappointed. And I didn't know that I was in contention to be on the Charlie Sheen roast. And then I found out a couple weeks before that they were thinking about maybe putting me on the dais. And then I found out 2 weeks before that I was going to be on the dais and roasting Charlie Sheen. And so I had those 2 weeks to get myself ready for that.
Have you said anything at a roast that you've regretted?
No. I have not said anything at a roast that I regretted. No.
You did say one thing about Ryan Dunn from Jackass after he died.
I guess you regret me saying it.
I have no position, and okay. I didn't hear the roast. I just, you know, read about it. But
right.
a lot of people were very offended by what you said, and you've said that you even got death threats afterwards. And
yeah,
and that's kind of scary to think about, that you're at a roast where it's like your job to say really insulting things, but then people could get so angry that they threaten you.
Yeah, that was really surreal. It was I said Steve-O, one of the Jackass guys, his friend, one of the other Jackass guys, had just died in a drunk driving accident. And so I said, Steve-O, I'm sorry for the loss of your friend Ryan Dunn. I'm sure you must be thinking it could have been me. And I know we were all thinking, why wasn't it? So the joke was sort of I felt like the formula of any roast joke. It's take something that you're not supposed to talk about and then twist that into an insult. And I thought it was very typical and didn't see anything that was too much about that. I'm also used to playing with comics, and just we go after each other so horribly. One of my friends at the Comedy Cellar, we, you know, they post the lineup of what comedians are performing, and one of them works under an alias because too many fans show up, and the alias he chose was the name of one of our other friends who works there, stepfather, who used to beat him up, who used to beat him. So, you know, just to mess with him. So we all just go after each other's jugular all the time. And I just didn't think that that joke was a big deal. I didn't think it was a joke about making fun of somebody who died. I thought it was a joke making fun of Steve O. And then people's reaction to it, I was really surprised because that joke wasn't a big deal in the room. At the actual roast, there wasn't a huge reaction to it. But the way it was edited, they cut to Steve-O and he looked so sad. And I'm sure if I saw that, I would have thought, oh, gosh, that was too much or something. But the way it happened and his reaction, and, you know, I've spoken to him since. He's a friend. I knew what my intentions were saying that joke, and I never felt like I'd made a mistake. And I've made several mistakes in my life, and I don't think I'm above it, but I don't think that was one of them. I stand by that joke.
There's a sketch on one of the editions of Inside Amy Schumer that relates to roasts, and I want to play a clip from that. And this is a scene where there's a dying child, a child dying of cancer in a hospital, and his last request, his make-a-wish request, is for you to visit him. So you comply, and you show up in the hospital. He's in bed with, you know, oxygen tubes in his nose and looking very deathly and pale. And his very worried parents are standing by the bedside. You walk in and stand next to him by the bed. And midway through this scene, the boy's doctor walks in, and the boy's doctor starts making jokes. You'll hear that.
Hey, Jason, I'm Amy. I brought this for you.
Oh, your headshot. Okay.
I just want you to know that you're really special, and everything's gonna be fine.
Well, I'm realizing that I bit off a little bit more than I could chew. It was an honor meeting you.
Oh, whoa, where do you think you're going?
I was gonna go get my car.
Don't you know why you're here?
I thought I was just supposed to come and meet Jason. Did I do something wrong?
Roast me!
Roast you?
It was our son's last wish to be roasted by a professional comedian.
Okay. Yeah, I don't feel comfortable making fun of your son.
You think I give a what you are comfortable with?
Okay. Nice. Why don't you get some more tubes in your nose, weirdo?
Is that even a joke?
Okay. Where's the rest of your hair? Is it the hair parade where there's no hair?
Enough with the softballs, please.
Okay. This is really hard.
Hey, little man. How you feeling?
Terrible.
Well, at least you feel the way you look. Right? Am I right? No, I'm just joking. You're dark and handsome. If it's dark, you're handsome. Okay, I gotta go.
LOL. Oh, Amy, take notes.
Those were hack one-liners from the internet.
What?
The internet. You know, the thing you won't be on in 3 weeks?
Wow. Hey. Amy.
That's not the direction we're going in?
No. He's ready for a laugh, but, you know, could you please make sure it's funny?
So that's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central. Amy Schumer is my guest. Amy, so we've established you've done roasts. How did you come up with the idea for that really weird take on a roast?
That wasn't my idea, that scene. That was one of the writers, Kyle Dunnigan. We were kind of talking about roasts and who you wouldn't want to roast. And he came in with that idea, and it really made us laugh. It's sort of like a little bit inside baseball with there's a lot of jokes for comedians in that scene, or even just that I would bring my headshot. Like, why would this kid want my headshot? And I wrote, "Have a great summer" on it. Just such a dumb little joke throughout the scene. But people just think that comedy can work anywhere. A lot of times we'll be asked to do a fundraiser or, you know, something like that. Or, oh, will you do stand up at my friend's birthday? And it takes so much for a show to be produced well and for stand-up to be successful or a roast to be successful. But people just don't realize that. They're just like, oh, tell me a joke. Whenever someone says, oh, just tell me a joke, like a cab driver, anybody, you learn the lesson over time to never do it. It never works. And this is like a scenario. The family where people are like, oh, do your bit, roast our son, and they think it's just going to be hilarious. And then, but it's really kind of hard and too awkward. But then that the doctor walks in, and is just doing jokes from basically a joke book, and they're killing. That's a little inside baseball comedy, because you know. You'll be working on the road and a comedian will go up and just be doing the oldest jokes ever told, and just the crowd will be dying laughing. And you're thinking, I cannot believe these people are laughing at this. These are the oldest jokes. He's stealing all of these. And then you'll go up and do some stuff that you think is really original and funny, and they just stare at you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actress Amy Schumer. She has a show on Comedy Central called Inside Amy Schumer. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actress Amy Schumer. She has a show on Comedy Central now, which is called Inside Amy Schumer. So let's talk about your formative years. You grew up on Long Island, and I don't know much about your family, but I do know, I did read that, I guess when you were young, your father went bankrupt. so I don't know what happened, but did it change your lives a lot? Did you lose whatever money you had as a family?
Yeah, I grew up, we were rich when I was younger. My dad opened a baby furniture company called Lewis of London, and they would import baby furniture from Italy, and no one was doing that yet. So all the, you know, I was born on the Upper East Side, and so all the Upper East Side rich people were like, well, I need a crib from Milan. So we were really wealthy, and then my dad was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis, and at the same time, other people started also importing furniture from Italy, and the business went under. And so we had to really downsize, you know, moving from a huge place to a pretty small house. And I really never felt the effects of having less money. I think my parents were probably whatever came in the aftermath of going bankrupt, my parents felt it, and I'm sure so as an extension, I felt it. But I was, I think, 12 or 13 and just, you know, boy crazy and worried about what I was going to wait, you know, just a shallow teenager. So I wasn't, I really don't remember feeling the effects of it that much. I had a joke about it that I would feel it, that I felt it in the quality of my birthday parties.
So your father got MS the year that... Mm-hmm. He went bankrupt when you were 12 or 13.
Yeah.
How soon did the MS really affect him?
It was pretty, it kind of hit him like a ton of bricks, and it was bad. And he was, couldn't feel his legs, and it was in the hospital. And then it went into remission, and he was kind of cool for years. But it would show up sometimes. It's like this quiet disease where you don't really understand it, because he would be fine, but then all of a sudden he would be moving really slowly, and he would be in a lot of pain, but could still do the day-to-day stuff. And so I really didn't understand it very, very much. And then it hit him where he's been in a wheelchair now for the past, I would say, 7 years. And it's bad. And my dad now lives in a hospital. He needs 24-hour care. And a doctor on call, because it's gotten to that point. But in between being diagnosed and now, it's been over 20 years. So
how did that change your life, having a father who had a degenerative chronic illness?
I think it has, the way I know that I'm different than some other people are, if seeing someone that you love and that was so young and alive and effervescent, like he was just such a New York guy playing tennis and always in the ocean. And then to see them, to see their descent, to watch his body sort of decompose, it's pretty, it really darkens you and it really lets you know that you have no control over life. And also my relationships. When I'm dating someone, I think, would I want to push their wheelchair? Would this guy push my wheelchair? My mind goes there if I've been dating somebody for a year or two. And I don't think that happens to people if unless they've taken care of a sick relative.
Since you were in your early teens when this happened, and probably very interested in your friends and boyfriends and stuff, did you push your father's wheelchair when he needed it? Or were you like so absorbed in your own, you know, in the transitions in your own life?
He wasn't in a wheelchair until the past.
Right. True. Right.
Yeah. He wasn't in a wheel. He wasn't wheelchair bound. He still had some money and he remarried after my mom, and he has always had people taking care of him where I didn't need to be that person. But he remarried and was living in New Orleans with a woman who was my step. My parents both remarried a couple times, so I've had step parents and sort of step siblings come and go. So this last stepmom, she knew him from the 70s, and it was like, oh good, I'm so glad this woman showed up and she loves my dad, because it would have been my turn. Had he not remarried, I would absolutely right now be my dad's chair would be in the hallway here. But I mean, God, I'm sure I would have taken care of my parents back then if they needed me to, I hope.
When you were in high school, you were voted class clown and teacher's worst nightmare. I think this was in 1999. What were your reasons for being voted teacher's worst nightmare?
That was an award that I won. And half my teacher, like my English teacher, my history teacher, were shocked, because if it was a class I was really interested in, I would just listen and be attentive and was a good member of the class. But if it was a class that I struggled or I felt wasn't, you know, like business law, I remember, those are the classes I would kind of act up in. And I've always just, I would say the funniest thing I could think of. I still am the same way with, like the other day I was on an Amtrak train and the train broke down. And so the conductor came back and he was talking to our car and he said, you know, the train is not working and we're going to switch trains. And people were saying, well, do you know what time? People were asking questions. And I just raised my hand. I'm like, who do you think is going to win The Voice? Just, you know, I just started asking the most unrelated, worthless questions. And it's the same stuff I was doing in high school. So it was just me making dumb jokes.
So when you did this on the Amtrak, that was recent?
Yeah, that was probably a month ago.
Weren't you a little concerned that somebody would go, that's Amy Schumer, and then tweet about it? And
I guess I'm in denial about that still. Like people will call my name now and it just scares the life out of me. I gasp every time. I am not used to that at all. And no, so that didn't occur to me. And yeah, that is true. I think that will hinder my being an idiot in public. I really do. And that is something I will really miss. You know, should this path continue, there's always a chance that I will slip back into obscurity.
Amy Schumer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Schumer's series, Inside Amy Schumer, is on Comedy Central. A new episode will be shown this evening. The first season concludes next week. You'll find a link to one of her sketches on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Sofia Coppola's new movie, The Bling Ring, gets our critic-at-large John Powers reflecting on teen obsession with celebrity and the stuff celebrities wear and own. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The Bling Ring is the new film from Sofia Coppola, who made Lost in Translation and Marie Antoinette. It's based on the real-life story of a group of Southern California teenagers who in 2008 and 2009 began breaking into the homes of Los Angeles celebrities and stealing their so-called bling, everything from designer clothing to watches and jewelry. Our critic at large, John Power, says that their crime spree says a lot about our current cultural values.
We live in a world filled with crimes, but most of them don't have much to tell us. They're cases of mere stupidity, cruelty, or greed. But every now and then one comes along that invites larger thoughts about the culture. Think of the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese, stabbed to death while nearly 40 witnesses heard her screams but didn't want to get involved. Or the 1974 kidnapping of Patty Hearst, which felt like the final mad curdling of the 60s political dream. Or the Ponzi scheming of Bernie Madoff, that hollow pillar of the community who came to personify the 2008 financial crisis. Such crimes felt emblematic. Of course, not every emblematic crime is heavy. Take Sofia Coppola's entertaining new film, The Bling Ring, about a posse of thieving teens from L.A.'s prosperous West Valley suburbs. It's a true story, but you could believe its plot was dreamed up by some witty professor of cultural studies who wanted to make a point about American consumerism and celebrity mania. Israel Broussard plays Mark, the new kid at school, who desperately wants to be cool. He becomes friends with Rebecca, that's Katie Chang, who's obsessed with fashion and celebrity. Brainy and amoral, Rebecca suggests that they break into the Hollywood home of one of her idols, Paris Hilton. They do, and they grab what they want from her laughably teeming closets. Soon, they and several friends, including a wannabe reality star Nikki, played by Emma Watson, are robbing the homes of other tabloid luminaries, Lindsay Lohan, Orlando Bloom, Audrina Partridge. Tracking their victims' movements on the internet, this so-called bling ring eventually grabs $3 million worth of designer clothes, Rolexes, Louis Vuitton luggage, and red-soled Labutins. We've come a long way from the days when the young created a counterculture or chafed at parental restrictions. In The Bling Ring, adult authority is so squishy that the kids might as well punch a blob of jello. Here, one of the mothers, played by Leslie Mann, tries to enlist her daughter and friends in a visualizing exercise about values.
Okay, so we are going to make vision boards about people who are demonstrating good character, like Angelina Jolie. So, what qualities do you guys admire about Angelina Jolie?
Her husband.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
Her hot bod.
Okay. Well, the hot bod is not a characteristic, but okay.
How long do we have to do this for?
Well, we're going to do it until we finish, and then we're going to move on to the fluorescence work.
If you're older than about, 19, you may spend the bling ring wanting to break into a chorus of, "What's the matter with kids today?" The bling ringers don't merely have a sense of entitlement the size of a stretch Hummer. They have all the moral intelligence of a vacuum cleaner. More feckless than sinister, they boast about their crimes, parade around in their loot, even post pictures on Facebook, which helps get them caught. Now, Coppola is no incisive social analyst, but her movie does get you thinking about the society that could produce the bling ring. After all, its young robbers aren't that far out of the American mainstream. Indeed, they're an almost natural offshoot of a consumption-crazy culture that incessantly celebrates the idea of owning fancy cars, fancy watches, fancy clothes. They're driven by the same heedless desire to live large that led grown-ups to run up vast, unpayable credit card bills, or to make millions selling off shares in worthless mortgages. Their enthrallment by celebrity is mainstream, too, endlessly reinforced by a 24/7 media that keeps pretending that nobodies are stars. In the past, to be famous, you had to do something. You know, have a hit song or win Wimbledon. Now you simply have to grab attention or possess the signifiers of fame. If you dress like Paris Hilton, you can be like her. So why not steal her clothes and wear them to the same club she'd go to? This isn't to excuse the Bling Ring's crimes, of course. Hundreds of other kids went to that same high school and managed not to be crooks or worshippers of Lindsay Lohan. And at the other end of the spectrum, countless other young people joined Occupy Wall Street to change the world. They wanted to narrow the gap between the privileged few and the vast majority who are made to feel like powerless losers. Not so the Bling Ring, whose members clearly see that same gap, but are blissfully untroubled by anything resembling idealism. Far from wanting to make a better world, they embrace much of what's shallowest in this one and are willing to break the law to get their share. Talk about rebels without a cause.
Joan Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Therabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Too many bottles of this wine we can't pronounce. Too many bowls of that green, no Lucky Charms. The maids come around too much. Parents ain't around enough. Too many joy rides in daddy's Jaguar. Too many white lies and white lines. Super rich kids with nothing but loose ends. Super rich kids with nothing but fake friends. Start my day up on the roof. There's nothing like this type of view. Point the clicker at the tube. I prefer expensive news. New car, new girl. New ice, new glass. New watch, good times, babe. It's good times, yeah.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, introducing the all-new 2014 Forester. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at Angie'sList.com. And from Dignity Health, healthcare with a commitment to human kindness and a belief in the healing power of humanity at HelloHumanKindness.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, why the Lyme disease infection rate is growing, and so is the battle over how to treat it. We talk with Michael Spector about his article, The Lyme Wars, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll also tell us what's recommended if you find a tick on your body or your child's that might be carrying Lyme. Join us.